All right, first question.
I just have a quick question about Jesus being called the angel of the Lord.
Yes.
And what is the reason for that? And a lot of times when there's a certain passage, the name he's given is an identity that is connected to what he's doing or what he's saying. And so in this passage, him as the intercessor, do you have any insight into why he's being called the angel of the Lord ever, but also in connection to this passage?
Well, there's, you guys, you could, I'm guessing 10 passages, I'm just making up that number, in the Old Testament. 10, 12, where the angel of the Lord appears. And he appears as a man, as an angel, and as God. And when you put them all together, it's clear it's the God-man before. And so that's a well-accepted conservative theological position. Mm-hmm. And we need to get somebody like Samuel, or really we just go on the internet, and get a good paper on the angel of the Lord. I'm sure there's 20 of them out there that lay it all out with every one of them, and then you got it all. But we probably ought to do that and put one on our website. There's plenty of them on the internet, yeah.
Yeah, the short answer to your question is I don't know if there's a significance in that particular passage related to that identity. In the Old Testament, it seems to be we're not quite sure who this person is. They look human, because angels usually look human, but they're clearly much more than human, and they're clearly in another category from all the other angelic beings. So the angel of the Lord is the messenger of God who is responded to as God and appears human, yet is heavenly.
And they worship him a couple times.
And we don't know who he is. So it seems to be a reach for language going, I don't know who that is, but he's in his own little category.
He's human. He gets worship. Like in this case, the man stood among the myrtle trees twice, and the angel of the Lord stood in the myrtle trees twice. Then the angelic patrol followed him. So he's more than an angel, or they wouldn't fall. And they answered to him when they gave their report. And then when the interpreting angel was about to give the answer, he spoke up and gave the other answer, and the interpreting angel went zip. You know, so he's a person of clear stature and authority, even in that scene. So what other person has authority over the angels that angels follow on horses and that kind of stuff?
And wasn't it with Gideon, the angel of the Lord appears to him, and he worships him. Yet when John falls down to worship the angel's like don't even worship me.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, when they worship in Revelation, John got in trouble. But the two or three times, again, I don't know if that's the real number, worship the angel of the Lord in the Old Testament. But
right.
We need to get a good article. Oh, no, there's...
So that was one of the examples in the Old Testament. of the God supernatural man kind of that they don't know they don't
yes.
have
right.
any
so
experience of
is.
That kind of
right.
being before
right. okay. But you know what, go home, use a concordance, look up angel of the Lord and take a look at it for yourself.
But
make a decision what you think about it.
If you want to cheat,
write a paper.
Oh, write
if you
a paper
want to cheat,
and give it to us.
Go get a paper off the internet. It's real clear and laid out. There's
just
about
don't
50
put your name on it.
Hey, but we got to get one. Who will get one?
She will.
We have a candidate.
Wait, will you?
I'll put it up there. I'll put it there.
Okay,
sure,
but she'll confirm it.
Sure,
I mean, maybe a 2 or 3 page one, not a 25-page one.
No, but I'll make sure.
Put you to work.
Kosher.
Ask hard questions. You have to answer them yourself. All right, John Haber asks, would you contrast Amos 4, verse 1, where God refers to Israel as cows, which by the context seems to imply they are driven by simple and base desires and calls them to multiply their transgression because they love it. Amos 4:4 against Zechariah 2:4.
No. Because in Amos 4, and I thought it was Amos 5, but maybe Amos 4, he calls the women cows of Bashan because they lived in luxurious lives, and he was rebuking them for being wanton in their pleasure and doing bad to the poor. So when I'm stealing their money, he called them, you know, you cows of Bashan who devour. So that was really negative in there. And so that's not the cows will be multiplied in the millennial kingdom.
And that's not the same as talking about men and cows, they have men and women. It's different to call men cows than to talk about there's men and there's cows and there's.
But in Amos is rebuking the aristocracy, the wives, because they were going, we didn't do nothing. Well, you're taking all the money that your husbands are stealing, and you act like you're innocent. You're not innocent is what Amos told them.
I'm wondering, when discussing these things with someone with a strong preterist view, what would you
your starting point be? Just hermeneutics or?
No, I would just say give us the meaning of what the passage means.
And just
I would start by
the
telling
passage.
Them to tell you did that happen.
All right.
It's impossible. It's just because they can pick 5 or 6 details out of the 20.
Yeah.
They say, cool. Say, let's go to the other 12 or 13 details. Just say, tell us.
That's exhausting. Yeah,
don't you tell them. Make them tell you. Yeah. And again, I don't ever argue with it. I just have fun with my brother's friends. We just have fun.
Right. Yeah, I'm in the same discussion, so.
But no, have them tell you, and the onus is on them to prove why those details are either false, but they're in the Bible, or how you could make that symbolic, and when did it happen?
Yeah.
They're just, it's impossible.
Yeah. Thank you.
Very inspiring message tonight. It really encouraged me concerning the end times and what to focus on.
Oh, good. And proclaim, I am zealous with great zeal for Jerusalem.
Rejoice in the Lord always.
Proclaim it.
I got a question, and I like that you're going to have a big paper about angels because that's kind of confusing, you know. But
yeah, our team will have it out pretty quick.
Good.
Our team is really efficient.
In Zechariah 2, verse 3, it says, "And behold, the angel who talked with me came forward, and another angel came forward to meet him." Is that the interpretive angel that was speaking for Jesus, and then another angel came forward? So there actually there's two angels?
Yeah, in that one right there, there's two angels. Because the interpreting angel is running off with the man to go measure the city, and the other angel says, "Hey, get back here with Zechariah." Isn't that a strange passage?
I think it's there just to show us the reality of it. I mean, if you were making up a story, right?
Yes.
You wouldn't add that because that would be like weird or dumb or stupid or something.
So
it just shows the truth of, to me, it shows the truth of this actually happened to him.
But when you first read it, if you don't know that's happening, you go, what? But then when you think, no, it's just what it says, then you go, okay, there you have it. Thank you.
Okay, question about the craftsman here. In verse 20, does the word craftsmen have any connection to temple construction?
Probably they are, but that's not the point that they're builders of the temple. The point is they have sledgehammers and they can tear horns apart real easy. Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know if they called them sledgehammers.
So, and so that's another question from Mary asks. So talk more about the four craftsmen in Zechariah 1:20. How will they terrify? Are these related to Revelation?
A good, which I have in the notes, a good position is that the craftsmen are the next empire that destroyed the most recent empire that attacked Israel. That's a reasonable view. So like the craftsmen that destroyed Babylon is Persia. The craftsmen that destroyed Persia is Greece. The who destroyed Greece is Rome. And then another, which I think is believable, the craftsmen are some of the angelic powers and decrees of God, you know, the Book of Revelation type thing without us knowing which four or which. I think that's believable too. Both of them are.
So kind of.
Oh, wait, you're saying yes, but you're asking for them. So then you're saying, I'm thinking you're saying yes for them. Thank you. Whoever you are, Reuben said it worked. He liked my answer.
Yeah.
Remember, it's not your answer. It's not your question. That's right.
I was just thinking, should I wear a camera on my
head? No, because you're shaking your head. And I'm going, okay, he's got it. I go, wait, he didn't even ask the question.
I have similar question. I have two. And the first is, does the four craftsmen be the symbolic?
Craftsman, okay.
Yeah, be the symbolic like Babylon, Greece and the Roman Antichrist?
Yes, like Persia might be the craftsman that beat Babylon. Yeah, Greece might be but it might be angelic powers because they're all over the Book of Revelation who are releasing judgments on nations. And all I know is God's going to take care of them. That's the real message. But I would like to have more confident detail. Do you have any insight on that, any of you guys?
It's half baked. That's why I was.
What's
looking.
That?
I don't.
Brian, do you got any thought on that?
Right,
yeah, I mean, either one of those could work, couldn't they?
Yeah. Okay.
Yes.
So the second question is: so Jesus here, chapter 1, verse 8, he's riding the red horse.
Right.
So, but Revelation is riding the
white horse.
So can it be like he's riding the white horse, but then the blood of the enemy is spilled and then the horse turned to red?
I don't think it has to be red.
Okay.
I think in the heavenly dimensions, it's saying that's war. this one, the white is victory. I don't know that it has to be a red one or a black one. I think the white one is really white. But the other, because in Zechariah 6, verse 2 and 3, there's four groups of horses again. And they have different colors. And they really might. I mean, God's so gifted and creative. They just really might be red. I mean, what's the problem? But we don't have to force that on the horse of Jesus. I don't have an opinion about that either way yet. Because I think it's a military thing. That's the point.
So the wall of fire, if Jesus comes and liberates Jerusalem and it's dwelling in safety, is there going to be a literal firewall around it in the millennium?
I bet. I mean, bet's a wrong word, isn't it?
We would say yes.
I
Something
think, yeah.
that can be described that way.
What's that?
Something that can be described that way, meaning it's going to probably be different than
we imagine. I mean, it's just the glory of God, and the burning bush was a real fire. Yeah. Exodus 19 mountain was on fire. The pillar of fire was real. Why not?
But he's not defending them from enemies, right?
But it's so brilliant you don't have night because of the glory of God emanating.
Well, when you think about it, right, during the millennium, we still have unsaved people there. And so he's not exactly defending them as much as because he's there as a presence. It becomes like a border, right? Because they really can't step right into his presence like that.
Burning one.
I mean, it's defending like the world champion against a 2-year-old. I mean, there's just going, hey, you're good. You're defending.
Right.
I mean, no one's gonna attempt to overthrow Jesus. It's like there's angels at the gates of the New Jerusalem. Yeah, who's going to sneak in?
Right.
Until the end of the millennium.
I mean, what's that?
Until the end of the millennium.
But I mean, there's all these kind of gates and guards and watches, and because the Lord just likes it that way. I mean, it's the way he runs his universe. He wants everyone involved.
Yeah. I have one more question about Zephaniah, and it's him talking about these people being complacent in Jerusalem. They say in their heart, the Lord won't do good, nor will he do evil.
Is Zephaniah 1:12?
And then at the end, it talks about how their silver and their gold will not deliver them in the day of the Lord's wrath.
In Zephaniah, right?
In Zephaniah. Okay. So my question is, can you comment on a prosperous Israel at the end of the age? Is that what we're expecting?
Before Jesus or after Jesus?
Before Jesus.
A prosperous Israel before Jesus will be one that is arrogant and trusting their prosperity. So that won't be helpful to them. It will be the Lord's blessing, but they will turn it into their own boast. And then God will break their boast. So it will be his blessing, but they will relate to it in a wrong way, and then he will break it.
So they may start out that way, like at the beginning of Jacob's trouble, but by the end, their money didn't do anything to help them. They've lost it all.
But it is true, they will be very prosperous.
Yes.
Extremely.
Yes.
Okay. So if someone was investing in Israel right now.
Oh! But they had a good heart, right?
Yeah. A great heart.
Okay.
Just make sure you take it all out for the abomination of God.
What do you do with that?
I think they're going to do great. I think Israel's going to prosper dramatically. But again, the Lord's saying, Israel, I'm going to bless you because I told you I would. But I want you to be humble when I do it, but I know you won't. But then when he breaks them and then shows them mercy forever, they live in the testimony that then they're grateful and humble forever in their prosperity. So he even uses that redemptively.
Yes,
they will prosper, yes.
Yeah, I think God's going to simultaneously try to draw Israel by his kindness, which will make her prosperous, and Israel will simultaneously demonstrate the human response to God.
Of the arrogance.
Which is we become arrogant and proud, which is a human problem, not an Israel problem.
Yeah, it's an American problem.
But Israel's going to demonstrate that in an ultimate way. And actually, I think this is one of the biggest challenges. I think people are trying to get their head around Israel's suffering. We should help them or stand with them or suffer with them. But people aren't thinking, how do we become a prophetic witness? God's being really kind to you, but God's also trying to call you to repentance before things change. And that's a huge challenge we need to get our head around right now.
I think they are going to prosper.
Just
make sure you get all your investment out before the abomination.
Right.
If
there's a statue in Jerusalem,
just quick.
Withdraw your funds.
But the thing with investments, it's all about timing. So you don't know when to invest.
But if they're... Yeah.
There's no seven-year treaty yet? You're good.
If they get it out before the temple starts the sacrifice going again.
Go ahead.
So maybe you'll answer this in your updated notes, and maybe Constable mentions it, but is there any spiritual significance to the date that he received the eight visions, like any other historical events?
My guess is yes. Probably. I'm not good at that, but God, like I like to say, he's an architect, a scientist, a historian, he's a poet, he's a king. He just makes everything rhyme and add up. It's just like, but like I'm not good at that.
There's got to be something special. But
I'm not that great of a poet.
I think it also,
I think yes.
I think it also just shows us the historicity.
The
historicity that it actually happened, that he can date it to this person, this guy was ruling, it happened this day. You know what I mean? It makes you realize that it's historical. It's historical.
Oh, historical. Yeah. And
historicity.
Historicity.
Sound like a...
Yeah. Okay.
Thought it was an operation or something. I didn't know what you said. Never mind. Go ahead. I thought,
it's not a procedure. It's actually
never mind. Never mind. I was completely thrown off. I went...
It means it's real history.
Never mind. I shouldn't have said that. I just was thrown off legitimately.
All right. Question from Luke. He asks, since Zechariah and Haggai are building off of each other.
Luke
Whitbread.
No, not my Luke.
Yeah, no. Not your Luke.
Luke. Because he comes better. To this. I didn't see him tonight. I go, Luke,
but,
you're trying to get
but
me.
But Luke is our Luke. Okay. He's always asking good questions. Okay. So since Zechariah and Haggai are building off of each other, can you expand on Haggai prophesying over Zerubbabel, Jerusalem's governor, as his signet ring? What implications does someone being marked as a signet ring have on the end times?
In my opinion, that is Haggai chapter 2, verse 20 and 21, the very last. That to me is a millennial promise for him. Mm-hmm. That is something in the age to come. There are about, I'm making up this number again, 10, 12, 14, I don't know the number, I've got the list, people who God, Jesus gave, I mean the Lord, Old and New Testament, gave promises for the age to come, mm-hmm. their role, part of their role. Isn't that amazing? And I think he's one of them in that one little verse 20 and 21.
So first, quick thought on what Chris said. There's another fire, an angel around Garden of Eden immediately after the fall.
Yeah. So there you go.
I think that tends to
Wait, where'd
literal.
Chris go? Yeah, there was a fire. The cherubim
the flaming sword,
yeah. with a flaming sword in the Garden of Eden. Yes, thank you.
So my observation on the use of the word pre-incarnate Christ compared to the usage of the word Christophany. So Christophany meaning more of the appearance of Jesus in a bodily form, only in an appearance.
Yeah.
Versus
that's probably a better word,
right?
It's like
but versus
whatever that was
pre-incarnate, meaning physical manifestation of Christ. So there's equal arguments on both sides.
Yeah, I think that's a good term.
Yeah. So I think is it's worth researching and doing paper on it.
I think for the most part, both of those words pretty much refer to the same thing, don't
sure.
they?
Yeah, always but pre-incarnate Christ is a very familiar theological
right,
term, though.
Right.
It's used for many, many generations.
In bodily form versus in appearance of a bodily form. So, I mean, we can argue all day long there, I think, equal number of verses. But isn't it
and what's
true?
What's the word you called it?
Theophany.
Christophany. Or theophany. Christophany versus pre-incarnate Christ. So, isn't the more important emphasis is on the message? Because really, angel of the Lord can be interpreted as the messenger of the Lord,
yes.
carrying the message of the Lord.
Because angel means messenger, yes, right.
Yeah. But, that's my comment.
But that's probably one reason why that word works okay, because the word angel is a human or angelic messenger.
But
it could be a human one.
I'm not quite grasping the point, because incarnate basically means before the event known as the incarnation, mm-hmm. which would be the gestation and the birth that happens through Mary. So yeah. I'm not quite
so
sure what point.
I'm bringing up the point because according to my understanding of the meaning of the term, pre-incarnate meaning physical manifestation of Christ before the incarnation, as in pre-incarnate Christ, versus appearance of Jesus in bodily form, but only in appearance. Because in the ancient days, even in Hebraic
really
mind, there is a region meaning representing the king in his absence. So in a sense, the messenger
I think you
even
got a good
spoke
point.
In first-person terms to represent the king and his message. So there's, I think, ample evidence of that going on. But then there's the argument of, no, like Asher will say, no, Jesus did really come in a bodily form and ate lunch with Abraham. So I think there's equal arguments. But isn't the more emphasis on the message itself?
I sense you're a theologian.
I'm just asking the question.
No, I think the message is the emphasis. I think you're totally right. What he said.
Totally right. Good word, actually.
Hi.
You can't say hi and I don't get to say hi back.
I wanted to kind of go back to the craftsman question.
Okay, craftsman, okay.
And I know it's not super conclusive, but I just was curious on your thoughts behind why you think the craftsmen are other empires or angels. Only just with the thought that that word craftsman is also used for the artisans and Bezalel who are furnishing the tabernacle.
Well, they've got to be strong enough to destroy the four horn empires.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's just a guy on the maintenance team, how's he going to defeat the whole empire of Greece? It has to be something big.
Well, I just didn't know if it was like a reference to the tabernacle.
Maybe it's just a reference to somebody who's trained with Moses.
But they're destroying the four horn empires is the idea. Do you understand? The four horn empires have been gouging Israel and hurting them. So these craftsmen have to be big enough to destroy an empire. So it's got to be something big.
I think there could be maybe some work on a word study to see if there's some similarity in the word. But the point is the horns are symbolic, so the craftsmen seem to
because
be
the craftsman really
well.
Is a temple word. You're totally right on that.
Yeah.
Totally right.
And just since the passage is kind of building the temple.
But you could almost use the big hammer. that's the idea. Hit the horn.
And craftsman isn't necessarily a temple word. A craftsman is a trained worker who works a certain trade. And so it's used when it's talking about them, but you could also calls a guy who was building a house a craftsman.
Totally.
But they're in the temple for sure.
Just feels kind of like if it was another empire, they'd say like another horn or something. So I was just trying to kind of dig into why they were.
Yeah, because I think it's a hammer. A sledgehammer breaks a brittle horn easy. And that's the idea. And it shatters it. And I think that's the word picture. At least that's the one I have.
I'm just emoting how we're asking questions about the craftsman in Zechariah 1:20. Where on the earth do people? Just like, what is going on here?
What's the historicity?
Wow.
Well, I'm glad you learned something tonight.
I had a comment and a question.
Go ahead.
So my comment was on the wall of fire, and I was thinking maybe it might be referencing to Revelation 20, where it talks about at the end of the millennium that when the enemies surround Jerusalem, that God sends down fire and it consumes them. So that might be referencing that.
That fits.
Question was, what you said, so I love what you said at the beginning when you said the all 14 chapters have to do with the end times. And I was just wondering.
Mostly. 7 and 8 are not, 7 is not radically end times, but.
Okay.
But mostly, that's a mostly word.
Okay. This has something to do with, I think, chapter 1, where it talks about the four craftsmen and the four horns. What end times emphasis are the four horns and the four craftsmen? Like, how do they play a part in the end times?
They could be truly a historical statement, but the idea is at the end times when all the empire of the Antichrist and all the nations, the Lord says, I've made it clear. I can shatter this easy. Does it matter if it's the four successive empires that I beat or all of them at once? I can destroy them effortlessly. That's the big message. Isn't that the message?
Okay.
Good.
Thank you.
Good question.
My questions or maybe just comment.
Hi.
It seems like Zechariah seems to be a Christ-like figure, as you also mentioned that he was killed in the temple. And I was wondering.
Doesn't that make you sad they killed Zechariah?
Yeah.
I mean, he's this young prophet. He got the temple going. They built it. And then they killed him in it. The remnant did.
So strange.
Just,
I kind of felt that when you mentioned that. Of course, it's not in the Old Testament. It's Jesus.
Yeah, Jesus said
Jesus,
it. Yeah.
You know, enlightened us that what happened to him. I was wondering if you have any more expounding comments about what I felt from what you said.
No, that just makes me sad that it could happen from the remnant leadership. Because it's a few decades later, undoubtedly.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's just a sign of the waywardness, the crookedness of the people. And honestly, the picture looks like at the end of the millennium, the people turning with the, you know, Satan at the end and basically seeking to do the same thing to Messiah, who's been setting everything up. So I think it is a prophetic rehearsal. But he wins.
Actually, two really quick. Would you see any connection with the craftsmen to Psalm 149 and the saints with their songs and their... calling things out.
Same impact at the end of the day.
Okay. Yeah. Second
it
question.
The bad guys.
Do we know there was angels on the horse, or were they talking horses?
Well, I'm assuming it's angels on the horses.
Yeah.
Just Narnia we'll thoughts.
C.S. Lewis.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, C.S. Lewis. What was the name of his name? Bree, that's right. Anyway. Thank you, guys. We'll see you next week.